Scott, thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be here. I actually see some faces that I recognize, that I know, that I've dealt with. And I am very pleased to be able to have this opportunity to share a little bit of what is in the health care reform bill, law, the Affordable Care Act, and how it impacts not only dental education, but the oral health of the country. Let me begin by saying that I have no relationships to disclose of a personal financial relationship with any commercial interest. Having said that, let me remind you that healthcare reform was passed by the Congress last March, signed by the President. ADEA believes that it affects significant and positive change in the healthcare system, and to a large extent, it shatters the status quo, which certainly needed shattered. It's not a perfect response to what ADEA was advocating for, but it is unquestionably a critical step in the right direction, we think. Our primary focus was to achieve universal coverage that included oral health. That was the primary focus of our advocacy efforts. That position was entirely compatible with a set of guiding principles for healthcare that the ADEA House of Delegates adopted in March of 2009. We believe that, in fact, much of that, our goal, our focus, was achieved. As you know, the healthcare reform bill expands coverage to nearly all U.S. citizens. It includes important provisions related to improving oral health, and it certainly addresses key issues of importance to academic dental institutions. What it didn't address was an adult oral health benefit, and that was part of our advocacy efforts. So to that extent, children were mandated to have oral health services. We failed to get adults, and that is a battle for another day. So let me take six or so provisions of the healthcare reform bill and tell you how compatible they were with what we were seeking, and I think will inform you as to what provisions were in there that influences academic dental institutions and especially the oral health of the country. As I just mentioned, children are mandated to have oral health services up to the age of 21. The essential benefits package must include oral pediatric services. The healthcare reform law expands Medicaid eligibility for adults and children up to 133% of the FLP. And importantly, it extends children's health insurance program. You recall that one of the first bills that President Obama signed was the reauthorization of CHIP. You will recall that for the first time ever in that program, there was a mandated dental benefit for children. And that basically, and to some extent unfortunately, was the result of Diamante Driver's tragic death in Prince George's County, Maryland. The only good thing to come from that tragic event was the fact that it raised the profile of oral health on Capitol Hill. He died within 5 miles of the U.S. Capitol. At last, we had some profile for our issue, and I'm convinced that had that little boy not died, the Congress would not have been so willing to mandate that benefit. So out of tragedy comes at least a little bit of good. And also, the health care reform law increases the federal support to states to pay for the expanded Medicaid coverage. So coverage is good. We don't have the adult dental, but the coverage is good, certainly for children. Second of all, for the academic dental institutions, the Title VII Health Professions Program, they're very important to dental schools. This bill created a separate dental section for basically training in general pediatric and public health dentistry. And for the first time, public health dentistry was included, as was allied dental health, allied dental hygiene. For the first time, it makes dental public health and dental hygiene programs eligible to apply for these training programs. The importance of these programs and these grants was recently identified because HRSA let nearly $44 million worth of grants coming from the FY10 appropriations and from the stimulus package funding for these kinds of programs. It makes dental schools eligible for grants that previously only medical schools were eligible for. These are very important and significant improvements for dental schools. And lastly, it created a new loan repayment program for general pediatric and public health dentists who agree to serve as full-time faculty. You know, we have nearly 400 vacancies in our dental school faculties. It's a real workforce issue, a real workforce challenge. And to the extent that this kind of incentive will encourage more individuals to think about a teaching career, to that extent, it's a very important provision. Just to make sure that we know what we're talking about, these funds, these Title VII Health Professions Programs funds, can be used to develop training programs. They can be used for financial assistance to those who plan to work in the practice of general pediatric public health or dental hygiene. They can be used for planning programs for those who teach in these disciplines. And certainly they can be used for technical assistance in these programs. The authorization from the Affordable Care Act was $30 million for 2010, and such sums as necessary through 2015. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Another provision, very important to dental schools, is a very esoteric and arcane one. And I'm going to try to get through it really quickly because your hair will hurt trying to understand it. In 1965, when Medicare was signed into law, graduate medical education funding, GME funding, was available to hospitals for physicians and dentists. At that time, hospitals could receive direct GME funding for dental residents training in dental schools. Now, what is direct GME? That is the expenses, direct training costs, salaries, fringe benefits, overhead that hospitals incur as they train residents, both medical and dental. On the other hand, the indirect GME is the operating cost for patient care. Hospitals who take care of, teaching hospitals in particular, who take care of sicker patients incur a higher cost, and therefore the IME payment is supposed to make up for those costs incurred by the hospital. In 1997, dental schools, the residency training in dental schools were allowed also to receive an IME payment. So that's background, basically, for this issue. In 1999, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services stated in a written letter that the time that medical and dental residents spend in scholarly activities, not patient care, scholarly activities, didactic training activities, was eligible to for reimbursement out of the GME pot. In other words, obviously, residents taking patients and providing care is an eligible activity. In 1999, CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, said also when these residents are in training or scholarly activities, journals, conferences, that time could also count. That was great. That's very important to dental schools. However, in 2001, they arbitrarily changed that decision. CMS is known to be arbitrary frequently. ADEA dealt with CMS for years after 2001, trying to get them to go back to that 1999 letter, and they wouldn't do it. So we went to Capitol Hill, we went to some of our champions, we asked them to fix the problem that CMS was unwilling to fix, and to a large extent they did. In the health care reform proposal, there is a provision that would allow the time spent by dental residents in scholarly activities to be reimbursed for direct, not indirect, but for direct GME. So that was a huge and very important success story in the healthcare reform bill. I won't go into it, but CMS recently, in a proposed and then a final rule, has completely vitiated the congressional intent on this issue. And they have twisted and turned the interpretation, the implementation of the statutory language to the point that basically we are back to where we began. We are not done fighting with CMS, obviously. Another provision is the National Healthcare Workforce Commission, very important to the future of oral health and the workforce of oral health. It established this commission, whose goal it was to provide comprehensive, unbiased information to Congress and the administration on how to align federal workforce resources with our national needs. The importance is that Congress will use the information and data when they consider making appropriations for discretionary programs. All of the oral health programs in the federal budget are discretionary, which means obviously they can be funded or they can't be funded. They can be increased or they can be decreased. Unlike the mandatory, which would be Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all of our programs, Title VII, Ryan White, all of them are discretionary and all have to go through the appropriations process. The membership on the commission has got to include a dentist, and in fact, the names were released recently. And Dr. John Maupin, who is the president of Meharry University, has been appointed to the commission. Dr. Maupin is a dentist. I wish, in fact, there had been more than one dentist, but that's usually the way things go. The MDs and the PhDs, and sometimes even the RNs, are well represented, the dentist not so much, but at least we have one on this commission. And this is a stated goal of the commission relative to one of its topics, its priority topics, the education and training capacity, projected demands, and integration with the healthcare delivery system of the oral healthcare workforce capacity at all levels. In the previous session, a gentleman basically said, why is the mouth not part of the body? Why is oral always separated from healthcare? Why do you sign up for a health insurance plan, but then you always have to sign up for a dental health insurance plan? And primarily, it's because oral health has not and is not integrated into the American healthcare system. Back in 1965, organized dentistry successfully kept oral health, dental, out of Medicare. They still consider that one of their top successes. And as a result, many members of Congress, many policymakers at the federal and state levels don't appreciate the importance and value of oral health, don't understand its significance and integration with overall general health. And we still, very often on Capitol Hill, and probably in state capitals, still kind of feel like we're Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill all the time, trying to get the profile of oral health increased. So the Workforce Commission, we think, has a lot of potential. We have a voice on there. We'll be trying to provide whatever information Dr. Maupin needs, and trying to influence the integration of oral health into general health in the healthcare system. You also know that one of the provisions was a five-year national public education campaign focused on oral health care promotion and education. The target audiences, children, pregnant women, the elderly, individuals with disabilities, and ethnic and racial minorities. This provision provides grants to all 50 states to develop oral health leadership, to build data systems, and believe me, we are so lacking in data. When you go to Congress, they want to see the data. You tell me what you believe, you tell me what your position is, what do you support, what data supports what you're trying to advocate for. And we are sorely in need of better and more comprehensive data relative to oral health. It also provides grants to demonstrate the effectiveness of research-based dental care disease management activities. The National Health Service Corps was reauthorized, and the funding was increased significantly. A change was made that half-time services and teaching was able to be counted for 20% of the service commitment, and it increased the annual loan repayment maximum award from $35,000 to $50,000. All of the diversity programs that come under Title VII were reauthorized, and in large part, the authorization increased the funding level. So Centers of Excellence, Health Career Opportunity Program, Scholarships for Disadvantaged Students, Faculty Loan Repayment Program for Minorities, all of them reauthorized again. Another important commission, although there are some in Congress who don't like commissions, and that's going to be debated here in the next months. A lot of commissions were established under health care reform. Also, the Secretary of HHS has tremendous powers under this new law. More than 1,000 references are made in that bill to the Secretary of HHS shall. This Medicaid CHIP Commission, which should be endorsed by organized medicine, because one of the aspects of their investigation will be the payments for dental services and process for updating the payments to all dental health professionals. So this is a, in my mind, this is a source that we can go to and make the case why Medicaid needs to be reimbursed better. Organized medicine is constant on that theme. ADEA agrees with it. We have a broader picture, but there is no doubt that Medicaid, the government, both federal and state, have got to make a better commitment to Medicaid and to oral health services. On this commission also, they're intended to be dentists. Lastly, you're aware that there is an authorization to study different alternative dental health provider models, which would include the ADA's community dental health coordinator, the advanced practice dental hygienist that the American Dental Hygienist Association has sponsored, and a number of other ones, including the ones in Minnesota. The authorization was significant for those demonstration projects. You know that organized dentistry opposed this provision, continues to oppose it, and it will go forward. So that's, in a very brief overview, that's what was in, some of what was in the health care reform bill that ADEA was focused on that was good for dental schools, that was good for the oral health of the country. Let me just momentarily talk about the authorizations of these programs and the money that was, quote, authorized to be spent is not the same as having that money appropriated. And you know that there is an authorization and an appropriations process to the federal budget. None of these programs, perhaps except one that recently came to my attention, none of the monies were appropriated. So All of these programs have got to receive money through the federal budget process. Now, we had an election a week ago. The Republicans have taken the House. Next Monday, the Congress will convene in a lame duck session. The government, the federal agencies, and the federal programs are working on what's called a continuing resolution. That is the funding level the same as last year. We're already into fiscal year 2011, but everybody in the government's getting paid, so to speak, on what they made in 2010. That continuing resolution ends on December the 3rd, so the Congress has to do something. The lame duck session has to do something. Now, what could it do? Well, it could extend the CR, the continuing resolution, into next year when the Republicans have control of the House. They don't have control next week. They could continue the CR the whole next year. The lame duck session could try to approve the appropriations bills, some of which have been passed out of committees, appropriations committees, but not out of the Senate nor the House. The lame duck session could try to approve an omnibus bill where they throw all 13 federal appropriations together in one big pot, stir it, pass it, and we have new funding levels for fiscal 2011. My perspective, and I have no idea what they're going to do, and I don't think they do either. Next Monday is going to be very interesting. Lots of people are coming back that for one more time. They're not coming back next year. Some new people are coming in. For instance, the new senator from West Virginia is coming in as a member of the lame duck session because he was elected in a special election because of the death of Senator Byrd. So he will be sworn in next week and become part of the lame duck session, where the new other members, the senator from Delaware, the senator from any of the new senators who have been elected, will not be sworn in until the next Congress. So if I were a Republican, I'd say, we want to cut spending. Everybody knows that. We were elected on that. So let's not do anything in this lame duck session except extend the continuing resolution. Then next year when we get control of the House, we'll do a lot of cutting. Whatever they do next week, the challenge to those of us in oral health and dental education and dental research, the challenge has increased significantly. Significantly. There are new members of Congress coming, both in the House and the Senate, who are, it appears, dedicated to cutting the federal budget, cutting the role of government, and it remains to be seen how the balance of power. The Democrats will continue to hold the Senate, they hold the White House, but the Republicans will hold the House. And whatever occurs, it will be a compromise if anything occurs. So it's a very interesting and a very challenging future we're up against. And I would suggest that there's going to be lots of activity for you all in with regard to the issues that are important to you, at least at the federal level. And one other thing I just want to mention briefly, and I'll conclude. There were 11 new Republican governors elected last Tuesday, in states where they had previously had a Democratic governor. Governors are going to be very important in whatever happens on health care reform. You know, there are many Republicans that want to repeal and replace health care reform. And the House will vote on it, and the House will vote to repeal. The Senate may vote on it. If they do, they will not vote to repeal. Even if the Senate voted to repeal and the House voted to repeal, they could not override a two-thirds majority vote because the President would veto it. So healthcare reform as we know it is not going away, but it could be starved through the appropriations process. So that's what we're up against, and the governor is going to have a large role to play in the implementation of some of the provisions that survive, because many of those provisions are at the discretion of governors at the state level. For instance, how the exchanges are put together at the state level, the exchanges whereby people and companies can purchase insurance, that is at the discretion largely of governors with the approval of the federal government. So the governors, in addition to being in charge now of redistricting in 20 states where before they weren't, they have this added capacity to really influence how certain provisions of the health care reform law are implemented. So again, another challenge. Thank you very much. We'll have opportunity for questions later. And I, again, thank you for inviting me.